Good evening and welcome to Behind the News for September 6, 2007. This is Doug Henwood, and we're here looking, as we do every week at this time, or most weeks at this time, at the worlds of economics and politics. And we've got two segments up for tonight. Surprise, surprise. First, in a few minutes, we'll be speaking with James Parrott of the Fiscal Policy Institute about their State of Working New York 2007, which is a report released for Labor Day. Couldn't do it last Thursday because that would have been ahead of time, even though I had access to the thing. But these are under embargo until the release date, so we had to wait for that to pass. So we'll be speaking to James Parrott about what's been going on in the New York State economy in recent years. And as you might guess, things are a little better than they were a few years ago, but they're still very far from great. And then at the bottom of the hour, an interview recorded earlier today with Desmond Lockman, who is a fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, an unusual place for one of a Behind the News guest to hail from. But he had a letter in the Financial Times today, which piqued my interest. This guy, who is at the very right-wing AEI, spent 25 years at the IMF, is concerned that the Federal Reserve is being too slow to react to the housing bubble imploding. Kind of unusual to get that point of view coming from someone with a resume like that. So decided to call him up and see where he was coming from. And we'll hear that interview at the bottom of the hour. And before we get to all that, a few words on the recent economic news, which, of course, is about housing, where the bad news keeps on coming. Yesterday, the National Association of Realtors reported that pending house sales fell to a six-year low in July, down 12% from a year earlier, about six times as much as economists were projecting. That put the stock market in a bad mood yesterday. And this morning, the Mortgage Bankers Association reported that the share of mortgages on which foreclosure proceedings were begun in the quarter rose to yet another high, the third consecutive record. That is the second quarter of this year, the quarter ending in June. As of June, 1.4% of all mortgages were in foreclosure, which is not a record, but just shy of one. And the numbers are almost certain to rise in the coming months, as even the Mortgage Bankers Association concedes, and that's not an organization known for talking trash about real estate. 1.4% may not sound like a big number, but it represents hundreds of thousands of people who had foreclosure begin on them in the quarter. The problem is worst in the Midwest, hit by the continuing loss of manufacturing jobs, and in the Gulf region, which is still reeling from Hurricane Katrina. And the problem continues to be driven by the so-called subprime sector, that is, loans made to poorer people or those with spotty credit histories. About 15% of such loans, and there are over 3 million of them in total, are past due, and about almost 10% are seriously past due, that is, 90 days or more. Foreclosures were begun in almost 3% of all subprime mortgagees in the second quarter, and well over 5% of such loans were already in foreclosure. So we're talking of several hundred thousand people there who were either in foreclosure or proceedings were beginning. And as I said, that's only almost certain to get worse in the coming months. These numbers aren't records yet. They're still below 2001 recession levels, but it's remarkable that we should be experiencing recession levels of trouble 6 years into an economic expansion when things are about as good as they're going to get. So far, the Federal Reserve seems unalarmed. At the yearly ruling class gathering sponsored by the Federal Reserve Bank of Kansas City, held in Jackson Hole, Wyoming, at the end of every August, Fed Chair Ben Bernanke said they're following the problem, but he stopped well short of sounding like the rescue party. The Fed's so-called Beige Book, an anecdotal roundup of economic news from around the country, which is published every 6 weeks, reported that the housing problem was largely contained and is not spreading into the broader economy. We'll hear a dissenting view of that on that at the bottom of the hour. And there is also a strong dissent filed at the Jackson Hole Conference itself, where UCLA economist Edward Lemer showed that 8 of the last 10 times that housing went into decline, the broad economy followed into recession. I certainly wasn't invited to Jackson Hole. I just got a copy of his paper. The two exceptions were during the wars in Korea and Vietnam, and I'm not rooting for that kind of deliverance. Besides, I doubt that bombing Iran, aside from being criminal and idiotic, would do much to help our domestic economy anyway. The latest indicators out this morning, first-time claims for unemployment insurance and monthly chain store sales, came in pretty well, which bolsters the optimist's case. But to use the favorite pundit phrase, it's still too early to tell whether this resilience can last. Much more to come in the weeks and months ahead, believe me. All right, let's take a little musical break, and we will be back to speak with James Parrott. And that a bit from a song from, I think, 2003 by Erase Errata, "A Thief Detests the Criminal, Elements of the Ruling Class." And there's a comma between criminal and elements, so it's criminal and elements of the ruling class, not the criminal elements of the ruling class, which may be a redundancy anyway. We are now joined in the line by James Parrott, who is the director of the Fiscal Policy Institute and the lead author of The State of Working New York 2007, which they publish, I guess, is it every other Labor Day, James Parrott?
Every other, yes.
Just as the Economic Policy Institute does with their State of Working America, and you do this in partnership with EPI, right?
That's correct.
So, things looking a little better than they were a couple of years ago. The economy certainly showing the benefit, or people actually showing the benefits of the expanding economy, but not quite as good as things should be, right?
Right, right. What we're seeing is that in 2006, there was an increase in median hourly earnings of 1.7%. That's good. That was better than the national average. There was an increase in median family income from 2004 to 2006. It wasn't enough of an increase just in 2006 alone to be significant, but over the two-year period, it looked a little better. There was also a decline in the poverty rate over the two-year period, also from 15% to 14%. But these are all positive indicators that we would have been better to have seen those earlier in this recovery and expansion, which is now in its fifth year, the economy having bottomed out after the Wall Street crash and the bursting of the dot-com bubble and the recession in the early part of this decade, where the economy bottomed out in the middle part of 2003. So the economy's been expanding for some time, so we say that it's about time that we're starting to see some positive movement in indicators that reflect the well-being of the average person.
And I should point out that you said at the beginning of this, you said median incomes are up, and median is the person at the middle of the distribution.
That's right.
Half earn more, half earn less. So it's not really being pulled up by all those hedge fund hotshots and their $1.5 billion annual paychecks, right?
Right, right. That would pull up the average, which has also been going up a lot better. And it's not only the median, this is the work in the middle, but what's even more interesting is that the 20th percentile wage, which is, we think a better indication of the typical low-wage or low-income worker, increased by 2.5% in 2006, whereas nationally there was even a slight decline. We think the better performance in New York State is largely due to the fact that New York raised its minimum wage ahead of the federal minimum, which only went up in July of this year. New York State, at the very end of 2004, the state legislature overrode a veto from Governor Pataki, voting to raise the minimum wage in three steps, the first in January of 2005 and the two following January. So this minimum wage increase at the state level largely accounts for the wage improvement at the lower end of the wage spectrum, and that distinguishes New York from the country in general. Again, sort of a positive development in New York compared to the national economy overall.
What is our state minimum wage now?
The state minimum wage is $7.15 an hour.
Which is $2 above what the national minimum was.
Right. The national minimum had been at $5.15. It increased by 70 cents to $5.85 on July 24th. And on the two succeeding July 24th, it will go up another 70 cents to the point where it's a little bit above the New York state minimum when it will be in July of 2009 at $7.25 an hour. We think that this positive minimum wage story in New York State, this occurred at a time when, you know, you'd be hard-pressed to find any adverse effect on employment in low-wage industries that employ minimum wage workers like retail or food service. We think we should build upon that positive experience and act now to restore the purchasing power of the minimum wage in New York State to what had been in the early 1970s the level that in 2007 dollars would put it about $8.25. That would be roughly equivalent to the hourly equivalent of the three-person federal poverty level. So that would be a useful standard to strive for. And then, of course, we should index it for changes in inflation, as 10 other states already do.
Now, I want to underscore two things you said. First of all, you pointed out that your standard orthodox economist, as well as your paid lobbyist for McDonald's, will tell you that raising the minimum wage will destroy jobs. There's no evidence that happened in New York State in recent history, right?
That's right. You know, the sort of conventional economics, you know, using a simplistic supply and demand model would say that if you increase the price of something, you're going to reduce the demand for it. Well, you know, that's simple economics. On one hand, the labor market is a different story. And in the real world, it looks like there's a lot of evidence now that employers respond to the context in which minimum wages get increased result in workers staying on the job longer, their productivity, they get to know the job better, their productivity improves. That's a payoff for employers offsetting the higher wage. Recruitment costs decline. That's a savings for employers, and so on. So, and they also adapt and learn ways to operate their business more efficiently, which is good for the business and good for the worker and good for the economy in the long run. So the adaptation that takes place and the changes that ensue from the minimum wage seem to have, produce a win-win situation.
Of course, left to their own devices, the employers wouldn't do this on their own. So they have to be forced to by raising the minimum wage. The other point mentioned that I want to underscore is that even someone working year-round full-time at the New York State minimum wage cannot earn enough to get above the poverty line for a family of three, right?
That's right. It's about 15% below that right now. So we're within striking distance of that and think that this should be a good policy priority for the legislature and the governor when they return to, considering how to buttress the New York State economy.
But also, you all also point out that there's some longer-term things to worry about in the New York State economy and in the labor market in particular. One is there's a big gap between wages and productivity. We have a very productive workforce in New York State. Business lobbyists, of course, like to complain about high taxes, but in fact, they get a lot for the money they spend here, we got a very productive workforce, but wages aren't necessarily so high.
That's right. I mean, it's not only the case that the average productivity of workers in New York is the highest in the country among large states, and it's 30% above the above the average for all workers in the United States. But it's also the case that productivity has resumed growing in this decade. In the latter part of the 90s, productivity grew at a reasonable pace, but so did average wages. That's not to say that we couldn't have done better in terms of distributing those wages to the lower end and the middle part of the income spectrum, but overall wages grew in tandem with the growth in productivity. In this decade, after a weak period for productivity growth during the recession in 2001 and the early part of 2002, productivity growth has resumed, but average wage growth hasn't kept pace. In fact, it's trailed far behind, and indeed it was only in 2006 that we get a median hourly wage increase at all after 4 years of decline. And, you know, it's positive to see an increase, but it wasn't enough to take us back to where we were at 2004. And even some, you know, again, this wage productivity comparison is based on average wages, and that reflects the fact that the higher paid workers have been receiving, better wage gains. In the wage data that we look at from the state, Wall Street workers, for example, stockbrokers and traders, their compensation's included in that. So, you know, they got tremendous bonuses in the past year or so. So that really skews the numbers upward. But even with that, wage growth hasn't kept pace with productivity growth. So that's, you know, the short story there is that we have a highly productive economy, but the average worker is not sharing fully in the prosperity that's being created.
Nationally, we had the Census Bureau reported that median household income just returned to its 2000 level in 2006, and it also took quite a long time for the labor market to recover from the recession. The official recession was over in 2001, but the labor market didn't bottom out till 2003. Did we see something similar here in New York State?
That's right, and it's only in the early part of this year, 2007, that we're back to the employment level that New York State had reached at the peak at the very end of 2000. New York State, largely because New York City bore the brunt of the Wall Street downturn and the economic aftershock of 9/11, and the employment decline was much steeper in New York City. That made it steeper overall for the state compared to the United States. So it took longer for us to regain the jobs that we had lost. Looking at payroll employment, we actually think that there's a development in the labor market that helps explain why there's been such weak employment growth. That boosts the numbers on the one hand as a positive thing. On the other hand, it sort of represents a deterioration in employment conditions for a lot of workers, and that's this growing trend for businesses to classify workers as independent contractors who used to be regular payroll workers. That has a big downside in that somebody who may be doing the same job they did as a payroll worker, now classified as an independent contractor, has none of the social insurance protections or employment benefits that they previously had. They're not covered by workers' comp, workers' compensation insurance, unemployment insurance. The employer is not paying the employer's share of Social Security payroll taxes or Medicare payroll taxes. They're not eligible for overtime payment if they're an hourly worker. They don't receive disability. They don't have any paid annual leave or sick leave or anything like that. All of those protections, the social insurance and employment benefits that we had taken for granted for decades in New York and in this country, are thrown out the window by this practice of misclassifying workers as independent contractors.
Any particular industries where that's happening?
Well, it's been a factor in the construction industry for a long time, but it's spread beyond that. It's a common practice among certain package delivery companies that try to reduce their labor costs by misclassifying their workers as independent contractors. We're also seeing it really grow in educational services. There seem to be a lot more consultants in the educational field in recent years, and even in social services and healthcare services. In this decade, in the real estate boom, there was a tremendous increase in independent contractors in the real estate sector compared to previous decades. Partly that was due to the booming real estate and housing market, but it also reflected this growing tendency for businesses to try and minimize their labor costs, misclassifying workers as independent contractors. If a worker is truly an independent contractor and, basically operates as a self-employed worker or as a small business, there's nothing inherently wrong with that or illegal about that. But if the worker is basically doing the same functions that a payroll worker would have done in the past, and doesn't have the autonomy that goes with being truly an independent small business, that's an illegal practice. That's an illegal employment practice. And more states are starting to focus in on this as something that needs to be monitored and enforced against. Governor Spitzer, in a speech in New York City, recently referred to this as, quote, an epidemic of misclassification that robs workers of needed wages and benefits.
I'm speaking with James Parrott, who is with the Fiscal Policy Institute and the lead author of their State of Working New York, which came out on Labor Day. And that's available on the website fiscalpolicy.org, fiscalpolicy.org. Now, we in New York State excel at a thing that we don't necessarily want to excel at, inequality. And as you say, it's high and accelerating. Tell us about that.
It's been the case for the last few years, although it hasn't always been the case, that New York has the widest gap between the rich and the poor. And sort of a common measure of that is to measure that by the average income of the top 20% of families or people, the top quintile, compared to the average income of the lowest earning quintile or 20%. So that ratio is greatest in New York, and the average income for the top quintile of households in New York is something like 18 times as much as the average income of the lowest quintile. So the most recent data from the Census Bureau confirms that New York still has that distinction as having the greatest income gap of all states. What's new with the latest income data is that we now also have the widest gap between the rich and the people in the middle. We used to be, around fifth or sixth in ranking among the 50 states, but we're now number one. And then what's also interesting in the recent data is that in this new data that the Census Bureau publishes, that indicates that the total income of the 5% richest households represents 25% of all income in New York State. And that's reflects a pretty high concentration of income. What's interesting is if you compare that with what I think is more realistic income data, that's data from tax records from New York State tax files, that according to that data for 2007, according to estimates from the state budget office, the top 5% will account for 46% of all income in New York State, share almost twice as great as the Census Bureau data indicates. Now, I think there are two basic reasons for that that make this tax data more realistic. One is that the census is just a survey, and it's top coded. That is, incomes above a certain amount, they don't keep writing down the decimal points and the places. If it's over $10 million, they'll write that, and they won't say that it's, $256 million. You can't do that on your tax return, obviously, so the tax return is more precise. And also the tax return reflects capital gains incomes, And there have been a lot of capital gains in recent years from the stock market and from the real estate market. And that's very highly those capital gains are very, very highly concentrated among the richest. Capital gains data is not reflected in the Census Bureau data.
So, as I recall, the top 5% has, what, twice as much income as the bottom half of the population?
The top 20% have 18 times as much. Well, I was thinking of the earlier ratio. So, let's see, the top 5% have, they have almost half of income, which would be the same as the other 95% of the population.
So if we just take away half their income, we could double the income of everyone else in the bottom. And this, I presume, is really being driven by Wall Street.
I think it's being driven by Wall Street and by the real estate market to some extent also.
Yeah, well, they're pretty close cousins. Now, the structure of the New York City economy is extremely dependent on Wall Street, never been so. And the turmoil we've seen on Wall Street in the last couple of months, what does that say we're in for the rest of 2007 going into 2008?
Well, I think the byword has to be, and the watchword has to be, uncertainty and volatility. And it's been very, very volatile. And, when Wall Street is doing well, the New York City budget reaps the tax revenue benefits of that. And it, creates a lot of spillover economic activity in the city. And then when Wall Street's not doing so well, as was the case in 2002 and 2003, that, acts as a powerful drag on the city and the state economy too, for that matter. So, it's a little early to tell exactly how that's going to shape up, but I think city budget officials are keeping a close eye on that, and state budget officials also.
We've only got about a minute left, but you have some stuff about projections for the kinds of jobs that New York State is likely to create in the coming years. What do those look like?
Well, what's interesting is that, people always, policymakers always say, well, in a globalizing economy, the surest way for people to get ahead is to get more education. So that's sound advice, and, I don't want to contradict that, but I would just say that's not enough, because the educational requirements of our jobs is not increasing very fast at all. In looking at projections through 2004, it only inches up a little bit. We already have a labor force in New York that's more highly educated than the jobs that will exist in 2014. That suggests that if there's going to be more broadly shared income growth and a decent living standard, that we have to work on the demand side for jobs and improve the quality of jobs. And we can do that, I think, by raising the minimum wage, by enforcing against misclassification of workers, and by working with businesses and workers to raise the skill level and the productivity of businesses in New York.
All right. Well, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
I've been speaking with James Parrott, who is the director of the Fiscal Policy Institute and the lead author of the State of Working New York 2007, which is available on the Fiscal Policy Institute's website, fiscalpolicy.org, fiscalpolicy.org. And let's take a break, and we'll be back to hear about housing.
WBAI, listener supported radio, non-commercial in New York. WBAI, listener supported radio, non-commercial in New York, WBAI.
And this is WBAI, not only in New York at 99.5 in your FM dial, but also on the web at WBAI.org. And let's take my name is Doug Henwood. The program is Behind the News. And let's take a little musical break, and we'll be back to hear from Desmond Lachman.
Train, be my feet if it's too far to walk to you. If a train don't they all get a jet or a bus, 'cause I'm gonna find you. You're gonna see my shadow soon around you. In my head is my only house unless it rains. I've walked the meadow plains, while the desert's on my eyes until I find you. I won't sleep until I find you. I won't eat until I find you. My heart won't beat until I wrap my arms around you.
And that's a bit of Captain Beefheart's My Head Is My Only House Unless It Rains from 1973's, or 72's rather, Clear Spot. One of my favorite albums of all time. And the standard of line among a lot of economists and even people around the Federal Reserve is that so far the decline in the housing market and the financial turmoil it provoked in recent months is largely a localized event. It's not yet spreading into the broader economy, and so drastic measures of rescue are not in order. I saw a letter in the Financial Times this morning from Desmond Lachman, who is a fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, a right-wing think tank, and I went to discover, looked at his resume. It included 25 years at the IMF, and he was complaining that the Federal Reserve must move in and rescue the economy from this housing implosion, or we could have some very, very serious consequences. I thought that was kind of a strange corner for that kind of analysis to be coming from, so I thought I'd give him a call and ask to him to expand upon his analysis. So here's an interview recorded a few hours ago, Desmond Lachman of the American Enterprise Institute.
There's a lot of analysts who are saying that the housing problem is really contained, that it's just in that sector and it's not going to spread seriously beyond into the broader U.S. economy. You don't seem to agree with that position. Why not?
No, I totally would disagree with that. You know, firstly, it's already spread into the rest of the economy, you know, that we've got credit market in a total funk as a result of a problem of subprime lending. Banks simply distrust one another. They won't lend to one another because of large losses. You know, Bernanke's talking about at least $100 billion of losses. So we've got the credit markets that are freezing up. But I think that more to the point is we've got housing prices now. They're already declining at a rate of about 3.5%, and that decline is likely to be very protracted, 2007-2008, and the slump in housing isn't going to be restricted to the housing market, but what it's going to do is it's going to spread to things like consumer confidence, and consumer spending is 70% of the economy. So what the real danger right now is that if the housing slump continues to deepen, as I fully expect it to do, we could get the U.S. economy subject to a very heavy body blow in terms of consumer spending. And, you know, for that reason, it really does surprise me that the Fed is so slow in firstly recognizing that there's a real problem, and secondly, you know, more importantly, in responding to that program by beginning to cut interest rates.
Let's just talk a little bit more about the transmission of the problem. Is it a wealth effect, a psychological effect, the mortgage equity withdrawal? What when housing prices spreading into consumer spending?
Well, it's like you're suggesting, it's multiple. I don't think that you should just be looking at it through a single transmission mechanism, but one would think that when people's wealth is really being reduced, we're talking about in the U.S. 70% of the population, 70% of households are homeowners, and that is their principal source of wealth. You know, when they see that source of wealth declining, that is bound to have a psychological impact on the way in which they feel about, you know, their need to increase saving going forward, and that would affect their consumption decision. At the same time, what's been occurring the last number of years is literally hundreds of billions of dollars has been extracted from rising housing wealth in the form of mortgage equity withdrawal, and that is drying up. So that is another channel by which this impacts the consumer.
Let's step back a bit. There are few, if any, precedents for the kind of boom in housing that we saw over the last 5 to 10 years, depending upon where you want to date the beginning of it. How do you think it got started, and what kept it going and took it to such extremes?
Well, you're absolutely right that this is a boom that one hasn't seen in U.S. history. We're talking about house prices in real terms having increased by 8% between 2000 and 2006. Now, the reasons why housing boomed like this, that there are many people who should be assuming the blame for this. You know, I would put a lot of the blame on the Federal Reserve by keeping interest rates for too long, and more importantly, by allowing these bizarre kind of financing instruments, you know, things like adjustable rate mortgages or negative amortization loans, or, you know, you don't need to check on whether people are creditworthy to buy houses. You know, that's how a bubble gets started. You know, once the bubble starts, it begins to feed on itself, and everybody thinks, you know, much like with the equity bubble in 2000, that this continues forever. You know, and one fine day, something triggers it, and there's a reversal. You know, and in this case, what really caused the reversal was the Federal Reserve beginning to withdraw liquidity, taking interest rates, you know, short-term interest rates, they took up from something like 1% to something like 6%, you know, and that dries up the demand for their housing.
Could the regulators have nipped this in the bud?
Well, the very least they could have done is recognize that there was a problem and said something about it, you know, rather than encourage, you know, the use of adjustable rate mortgages. But, you know, they...
Which Greenspan did, right?
Correct. But basically, the subprime problem, you know, that there are gaps in the regulatory system, you know, not a lot of the originators or the mortgage brokers, these aren't covered by regulations, but you'd expect that the federal regulators would have brought that to Congress's attention and something would have been done about it. We're talking about very large numbers, you know, that the subprime mortgages, the total amount outstanding is something like $1.2 trillion. That's huge. That's something like 10% of U.S. GNP. And these are really very bad loans. We've already got 15% of these loans in delinquency. You know, for the regulators not to have said anything about it, you know, as this problem was brewing, I don't think that that is excusable by any means.
Shouldn't poor people be allowed to buy houses too?
It's great, you know, if poor people should have proper housing, you know, you can make that argument. But I think that it's very cruel to put poor people into houses and then to kick them out of their houses after 2 years when their mortgage rates reset. You know, there was a fair amount of deceptive practice, you know, that will come, that's already coming to light in this. But, you know, we've got the risk. There's something like 2 million mortgages, adjustable rate mortgages, reset over the next 2 years. And many of those people are simply not going to be able to meet those terms. You know, we've already seen foreclosures at a very high rate. So, you know, the idea of having increased home ownership is great, you know, if you can do that on a sustainable basis. But, you know, I think that what this is showing us is that people were put into these houses, you know, with the promise that they could have financing, you know, and under the illusion that house prices would continue to increase. And as the party comes to an end, you know, there's going to be a fair amount of pain.
There are several analyses of how the subprime thing got really carried away. One would be that borrowers lied to their bankers. The other would be that the bankers lied to the borrowers about the terms. And you could also say that everybody involved was kind of had their critical faculties dulled by the boom. What's your preferred analysis?
Well, I think the problem is really the fact that loans got securitized, you know, meaning that in the old days what would occur is a bank would make a loan to an individual for 20 years and would stay with the loan, wouldn't sell the loan to somebody else. You know, so we moved to a system where these loans got securitized, where they got packaged. And what that meant is that the originator doesn't have an incentive to make sure that that loan is going to perform over the life of the loan. All that he's interested in is making sure that that loan doesn't default for the few months or few weeks that he's trying to offload the loan to somebody else.
Now, there are people who will say that securitization brought in much more capital into the mortgage market, allowing more loans at lower interest rates. Is that a good thing, necessarily?
Well, as I say, it's a good thing, you know, if it can be done on a sustainable basis. But, you know, I think that the rating agencies rated a lot of the mortgage packages as if it were AAA ratings, you know, once they sliced and diced them, inducing people to buy the mortgages. And what's now transpiring is that those mortgages weren't of a AAA quality by a long shot. So, you know, you've got a wide amount of investors to whom those mortgages have been distributed who now finding that those mortgages aren't performing.
I'm speaking with Desmond Lachman, who is a fellow at the American Enterprise Institute.
Now that we have this problem, what are we going to do about it? Let's take this in several phases. First of all, Congress is mulling over several things. They're talking about tighter regulation or better regulation. There are people who like to crack down on the rating agencies. What changes would you like to see to prevent a repetition of this problem?
I think that the two that you mentioned, you know, I think that those are things that should certainly be done from a long-run point of view, is that one's wanting to change the way in which the rating agencies have their incentives aligned with the issuers rather than with the people who are actually buying the paper. So you need a lot of reform on the rating agencies. And
as it is now, the issuers pay the rating agencies for a rating, right?
Correct. So that the issuers, the rating agencies' incentive is to have the deal done, have the deal closed. You know, the incentive isn't so much to worry about the person who bought the bond, you know, whether they're going to suffer a loss later on. So I think that that needs to be changed. The other thing that needs to be changed is that there needs to be better regulation, that we need to extend the net so that we don't have only 50% of mortgage originators covered by federal regulation. We need to get a lot more done.
And then what about the short-term problem? You earlier in the interview, you described this the seizing up of the credit markets as potentially being very damaging to the real economy. How do we address that problem?
Well, I think that the main way is through the Federal Reserve being more aggressive in its interest rate reduction policy. You know, so hopefully on their September 18th meeting, they'll start a series of interest rate cuts that will provide support, you know, to the overall economy. I don't think that they can do a whole lot about poor lending decisions that were made in the past. You know, and I think it would be wrong to throw a lot of taxpayers' money to try to prop up the housing bubble. That needs to correct, but what one does want to do is just make sure that the damage in the housing market doesn't throw the United States economy, the overall economy, into recession. So I think that really what one's looking for is a Federal Reserve that is a lot more proactive than it's been to date, but I'm not sure that I'm holding my breath.
Some orthodox financial types might say the U.S. could use a recession. We've had, there was essentially no consumer recession in 2001. We've just been on this long spending binge, and the economy could use some purging and discipline.
I think, you know, to have some slowdown, you know, that might be healthy, but to throw the economy into a deep recession, that just seems unnecessarily masochistic, you know, and doesn't serve much point. I think that what one's got to do is one's got to be looking at experiences of places like Japan, where when bubbles burst and policy responses were not the correct response, Japan struggled with deflation through much of the 1990s and had very poor economic performance. You don't want to go down that route. So the problems are very serious in the sense that you've got a very large bubble that is bursting. And as I mentioned at the start of this interview, house prices are almost certain to be declining for the next several years, that has to be dealt with care. That is going to have a rather deflationary impact on the economy, and that needs to be offset by policy action. You know, when clearly doesn't want to have an overreaction on the policy side, you're really wanting to strike the right balance to get a slowing, to get inflation, to maintain inflation under control, but to be alert to the economy not moving into a nasty recession.
I think some people might be surprised to hear a 25-year veteran of the IMF, and I was now a fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, talking about the Federal Reserve coming to the rescue of the economy. Don't we believe in free markets and the disciplines that they mete out?
We absolutely do, but the Federal Reserve is obliged by law to take action to safeguard the performance of the U.S. economy. You know, so the fact if the economy is showing signs of weakness, what the Federal Reserve is supposed to do is supposed to follow a policy course that provides the economy with support. You know, what I'm suggesting is that the bursting of the largest bubble on record, one really cannot sit pat policy that is overly restrictive. You know, that I think would be an abrogation of the Federal Reserve's duty.
Do you think there's anything to the speculation that Bernanke is trying to put the so-called Greenspan put to rest finally?
That is likely, but if that is the case, I think it's totally misguided. You know, that we really don't want to nail the U.S. economy to a cross of purging out a moral hazard. You know, that I think that just to try to punish the markets, you know, for bad decisions that they've made in the past, you know, if we're holding the rest of the economy hostage to that, I think that that is a major policy error.
But what about the moral hazard problem? We had, of course, Greenspan in the early 90s pushed interest rates down very low and kept them there to heal the wounds of the 1980s debt bubble. And then we had, which helped ignite the stock market bubble, which then burst and then led to a long round of low interest rates, which helped accelerate the housing bubble. Won't we run the risk of creating another bubble if we have another bailout?
Well, it depends on what occurs later down the road. Is that I think that the response, you know, Greenspan's initial response to the bursting of the equity bubble was right in reducing interest rates. The mistake was to take interest rates too low and to keep them there for several years and not to pay attention to the building up of the next bubble. So we're far from that right now. You know, we're talking right now about the containing the fallout from a deflation of a bubble. You know, so I think that you do need to cut interest rates, but one needs to be sensitive down the road to not holding these interest rates too low for too long.
And then finally, how can we tell in the coming weeks and months whether the optimists who think that the problem is contained or pessimists like you are right? What signs should we look for? So far, employment and retail spending seem to be holding up. Is it just too early for those to show any signs of weakening?
Right. Well, that's, you know, very much a lagging indicator. Right now, you know, what you've got is you've got the markets look like they're pretty seized up. You know, commercial papers dropping, interest rates, LIBOR rates are very high. Banks aren't lending to one another. It takes time for this to play out. And the further fall, the further deflating of the asset bubble lies ahead of us. So you'll see this in the numbers. The numbers that you're citing, you know, generally are regarded as lagging indicators. And Bernanke himself at Jackson Hole, you know, talked about needing to look at stuff that is more current, perhaps rely more on anecdotal evidence to see where the economy is headed. But my take on this is that all of this looks pretty serious, you know, in the sense that you do have the credit markets freezing up, and at the same time, you've got every sign that the asset bubble, you know, both in terms of the housing market and in terms of the credit market bubble, you've got increasing evidence that those bubbles are deflating at an ever faster rate. You know, and I think that that is a very dangerous combination, and it requires some sort of policy response.
And that's the voice of Desmond Lachman, who is a fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, a right-wing think tank based in a business-sponsored think tank based in Washington, D.C., and also spent 25 years at the IMF. So this is not the kind of guy you'd expect to hear talking about the need to come rescue the economy. You would think that he would be up there pushing discipline and the beauties of the market. But I guess when they sting the wrong people, when the discipline threatens to sting the wrong people, all those disciplines get forgotten, and it's time to call in the rescue party. And there were several obscure terms that were not adequately defined in that conversation, so I thought I'd point them out and define them. Securitization, I think we sort of alluded to that, but might not have been formally defined in that exchange, which is the practice that has come into wide use in the last 20 years or so of packaging together individual little loans, credit card debt and mortgages and things, auto loans and things like that, packaging them into bonds and then selling them into the financial markets. That means that lots of money comes into these markets when the bonds are sold, but it also means that whoever makes the loans has absolutely no incentive to scrutinize the borrower to see whether these are really good loans to make. If you can pass them out the back door almost as quickly as they come in on the front door, you don't really care much about whether the guy you sold the loan to is going to have any trouble in a year or two. So securitization, a very common practice, but a source of a lot of the credit problems we're seeing in the mortgage market now. He also mentioned negative amortization loans. Negative amortization loans is a fancy term for going deeper into hock with every payment. In other words, in the last several years, we saw a very popular form of mortgage loan in which the early payments are below the interest that is accruing on the loan. So early teaser rates, as they say, but that means that you're not even covering the interest payments, and that differential gets tacked onto the principal. So every month that passes, you're getting deeper in the hole. But 2 or 3 years down the road, those payments adjust upwards, and sometimes by a very dramatic amount, and this is what's happening right now. A lot of people are seeing those adjustments pushing the monthly payment into levels they just cannot afford. And then finally, moral hazard is a term that I think comes out of the insurance market, it means that when you're insured about something, you may encourage you to be more reckless. That is, if you've got accident insurance, you might be more reckless about your driving. In the financial markets, if you think that the Federal Reserve or the government is going to come bail you out, if you make some bad decisions, you're not going to be very careful about the decisions you make. So this is an interesting term, moral hazard, but that's the term that's in wide use. And I guess that's about it. I'll be back here next week. Let's go out with a little music. This is just out from Reverend and the Makers. He said he loved me. Proto-weekend dancing music for you. Stay tuned for the news and on until the evening. I will be back next week. Till then, bye.
He said he loved me. He said he needs me. He said to Kaylee, he thinks I'm special. He didn't love me. He didn't need me. Got off with Kaylee. She thinks she's special.
She used to go out, she used to get dressed up, and all the while, she's getting more messed up, and she looks out through the window pane as all her friends are going out again. She used to smile, she used to go to bars, now it's just rattles and baby food in jars. Know how she's feeling, because there ain't no text. I know she's reeling, they're at the multiplex. Mams and prams and 12-week scans. Wish you weren't a story of the also-rans.